I don't know exactly the nature of Mr. Sommer's topic, but I'd like to tell us in hope of peace in Northern Ireland and elsewhere.
The life direction of the program. We are not the ethnic connection. We are the Martin Buber trio. I, thou, and it. I'm thinking of forming a third group called Global Warming.
Oh, my joy is that there was a wonderful party here last night for the piano fundraising, the cabaret. And I wanted to especially thank Shirley because we used the round tables and it made a wonderful atmosphere. Thank you. I wanted to publicly thank Reed, although he's not here this morning.
He will be.
He will be out. If he is, we'll thank him later for setting up all the sound equipment, which really made a difference in the lighting and the quality of the show. And especially, we have to thank Nikki as our stage manager, who did a wonderful job. So, all in all, I thought yours, I don't know how much money.
I do.
How much?
Which leads to my house. About $385. Oh, also, need to thank the people who have the drink.
Absolutely.
We are aiming for probably between $600 and $700. So after the show, we're going to be putting another basket over here, and we'll be selling some leftover popcorn and things. And anyone who wants to give donations or what you care about.
Are you saying that this morning's presentation is the show?
Did I say after the show?
Yeah.
I'll let Danny about that. I was going to ask the issue with your but so we discovered we have a secret singer in the Xander band. And then you can do this and song by the time
you
miss something.
Thank you.
We had no idea.
I have two joys. My first joy is that I survived my performance. And my second joy is that I found this lovely purple thing. Where did you pull that up? Growing in my backyard. And I don't know what it is. And if somebody can identify it for me, I would be eternally grateful. And if you get close, there's a lot of branches, like 8 or 10 branches, and it's about 3 feet high. And there you go. I don't know what to do.
The genus, but they're about 110 species in cultivation.
Oh, goodness.
It's a companion.
Oh, it's a companion. Oh, so that's the one I planted last year.
All over the world, and there are lots of very common.
Thank you, Dale.
The woman in town here is one of the U.S. experts in genus.
And I had a sorrow this week. It was announced last week that I went to the bedside of my friend who was dying, and indeed he did die last week. He put up a 6-year struggle with AIDS, during which time he was ill most of the time. To imagine a person keeping their humor and not being complaining or saying at least too often or too long, why me? And also someone who I'm proud to say didn't bargain with God for some sort of deliverance, did, however, fight his disease too long. He went about 2 months longer than he should have in his family, in my opinion. And that he told me some time ago he's afraid he's going to lose the ability to make decisions, and indeed he did. And consequently, he existed in a very painful and delusionary state for quite a while, and that was a real hardship on his family and friends, and himself too, of course. But I think people should, what I'm going to learn in part from this is to make preparations in advance so that I don't get myself in a situation of inflicting that kind of hardship on myself or others, because it was very difficult. And I'm sorry to bring in that kind of downer, but
thank you for talking about it.
But he was a really nice man, and I'm going to miss him. His name is Bing Stemple.
I have a joy.
Yeah,
good. I have a joy. Yesterday, the day of the cover raid was my day of retirement.
Nancy, would you introduce our guest then?
Sure.
Would like to add a little music?
Oh, yeah.
I haven't read the program. I assume you
that's what we heard.
I looked around to see if I could find the Irish connection. I didn't find it. But who's still the Martin Buber trio? The name of the piece is Shabib Shamor, which in Gaelic roughly means big hill, little hill.
Group more in the East, where you have many people who feel strongly their ancestral Irish connection. And they're working primarily to let the Irish determine, as they said, their own destiny. That's their main focus. And they feel that once the British leave Ireland and leave it to the Irish, then their job will be primarily completed. Once the human rights abuses have finished there. So I've been working with Andy on and off. We've put on a number of programs here in Madison, many of them at the Public Library, some at the Press House, various videotapes. We've sponsored a speaker at one point from the IRA who was touring around the country and talking about issues. And Andy has traveled over there a number of times, talking to people in the IRA, talking to prisoners, and the abuses that they suffer, and many of the misperceptions that we have in this country because our media seems to be uninterested in reporting the actual facts. All that we get is just the one side. Much of it is because the news comes through the BBC, which of course is British connected, and so they will not, you know, report their, obviously their enemies, so they think their enemy's side. So I'm very pleased when Bob called me and said, you know, we need some speakers for June, and I was able to bring up Kathy Kelly from Iraq, or about Iraq, and I also mentioned Andy Summers, so I'm really pleased to have him here. Andy Summers. Thanks.
Thank you for inviting me to speak. I should mention a couple of things. One, I'm not Irish. I'm also music. But I was born in Brooklyn, New York. My brothers and sisters were born there. My father and mother were born in Brooklyn. My father's parents were born in Brooklyn. And my mother's parents. Mother was born in Brooklyn and mother was born in Massachusetts. So going back further, I find English, Dutch, I find Irish. So I'm not in this because I'm Irish. I'm American. I was a prosecutor for 20 years here in the state of Wisconsin. And, well, I got to about 50. I got to, there was a fellow named Chesterton who said the Irish, when the God made the Irish, he first made the men, for all their wars are merry and all their songs are sad. Well, he was being a little light about what's happening in Northern Ireland. But what happened to me is when I hit around 50 or 52, I went a little mad. I spent most of my time living in Madison, a nice homogenous society where there's very, very little reality. All my children grew up wearing Nikes and Adidas and going to all white schools and never having seen any conflicts. Somewhere around 50, I decided to take each one of my children to Ireland. It was going to be some little tour. And we did, and with each tour, I started heading up north. Now, how many people have been to Ireland? How many people have visited the north of Ireland? One, two, three. Okay. There's a big difference. And many, when you ask people about Ireland, they think of Southern Ireland. They think of the fiddles. They think of the sheep running free. They think of the Guinness, or they think of the singing. But they're a little reluctant to go up, for some reason, past this invisible border and go into South Armagh or across the Glen or Belfast. And rightly so, because it's a military camp up there. And it's a vast difference. But I wanted my children to see what most of the world looks like. Most of the world lives under the gun. And little by little, I got mad when I saw what happened in the north. As Chesterton prophesied, I became angry. And I became involved in civil rights or human rights, whatever you want to call it. And I picked Ireland simply because I liked it. And I spoke the language, and I just love the country. And I kept saying, once Ireland is finished, then I can look at Tibet or I can look at some other country. But Ireland is not quite finished yet. And since it's only 700 years, I may have a few more years in my traveling to the north of Ireland.
What do you mean by finished?
Peace with justice. Peace with justice. Not necessarily, and I'm not talking about whose flag waves. And I'm not talking about whether they bow to the queen or sing her song. I'm talking about the basic principle of justice. Peace without justice in the north of Ireland is a truce. There are warring parties there, divided up, as we are told, by a religious factor. Now, religion really doesn't play a part in this, as I see it, except as an excuse to kill people. I've never understood why God would tell us to kill other people, except it makes it easier. I mean, I could come up to you and say, I'm about to kill you, and it's nothing personal, but God told me to do it. That would justify it. And I'm not looking down at the English system now. I'm not trying to do whenever we tell the truth about Northern Ireland, we get accused of British bash. I'm not trying to do that, because England is not the only country. Our country is not pure white. There are other countries, as I said. I can go and find a smorgasbord of human rights violations. It doesn't have to be Ireland. What I found, it's not a it's not an English-Irish thing, although it's been going on for many years. Deep down inside, but it may be in my wisdom, I found that whatever one group of men, and I say that in a generic sense, is mean or cruel to another group, after you scratch the surface and throw away the religion and throw away whatever, they're shorter, they're taller, they're black, they're white, whatever, you throw away all those axes, as I call them, you find money. Money at the root of the conflict. One group wants money and the other group has a little or wants to share in some of the money. And it seems to me that's the great conflict in life. I'm not here as a socialist and I'm not here to try and redistribute money. I just simply recognize that money is a big problem, isn't it?
Would you say money and power are equal in that?
Yes.
Power is
Yes. Because tied up, when I say money, I'm talking about jobs. I'm talking about control. I'm talking about keeping people in their place so they don't get up anymore. We can look at our country, we have the same problem. So when I go over and I'm talking to people there, I'm not looking down my nose at anybody and saying, hey, you know, we're pure. We're not pure. We're not foreign. Policy, I won't get into it. It's just as murky, it's just as filthy. And the people we back, we have learned in America to rise above principle, which I find most politicians. We have also learned throughout, well, through the Christian world, to make God in our own image. And we create them, and in some of the great wars we've had the bishops blessing the Allies, the bishops blessing the Italians, the bishops blessing the Nazis. You know, you just wonder with all these blessings how they got anything done. But God was sitting up there with a little board looking at, you know, who's here and there. When I get to Northern Ireland, I don't find the black-white type that I see here in America. I see people of the same color fighting with each other. The people who look exactly alike. I mean, what I learned as soon as I get off the plane is that there's a great conspiracy. As soon as you get off the plane, you can't tell people where you're going, because if you tell it to the wrong person, they'll, you know, get mad at you. There's a little taxi cab lined up on the side, a little black taxi they have. And if you go up there and you look behind the wheel and you just little fellow with a cap and a cigarette, and he's got a little smile, and you say, "Will you take me to?" And then you give him an address, and his face turns into fury, you know, when he starts shouting and cursing at you, and you run away from the cab to the other side of the street where there's an exact same black cab with an exact same guy sitting in there with an exact hat and cigarette. And he mentioned the address, and he said, "Oh, are you over from America, did it?" You know. I don't know how they tell each other apart. It's what they hate each other. You know, and one of the things I humorously thought is that they need another, some more minorities in the North Island. You know, somebody else to hate. We can bring them in by shipboat. You say, here, you know, these are Spanish people, you can hate them. Here are the Jewish people, you can hate them. But bring them all in, you know, and divide up the hate so that we don't have but the hate is there. And the hate is justified with religion, it's justified with nationality. One group thinks they're Irish, the other thinks they're English. And you know, it just goes on and on. But it comes down to who runs the country. And who's police, you know, simple little things that we don't, like, who runs the police force? When you call the police for something, do they come? Or do they come a half hour or an hour later after everything's all done? When somebody is injured on the street, there's an ambulance come. I mean, these are simple little, we're not talking about God and motherhood here, we're talking about little individual things that could be headed under the idea of justice. And what we find is a subculture in Ireland of Irish people, as strange as it sounds. The native people are the outsiders, and they're not allowed to have jobs. And they're not allowed, for the most part, to have any voting, you know, voting to a point where 25 years ago they didn't vote, and they started marching. They took a lesson from us, and they watched Martin Luther King, and they watched the Civil Rights Movement in America, and they started to march, and they thought that they would be effective. And what they found is that they were shot and killed and beaten, and the army came in, and not to protect them, but to treat them as the enemy. And today, they are still considered the enemy. It's a very sad country, but as I said, you can go to other countries and find the same thing. There's no, you know, I just have to start off in Ireland. So I became an observer. I go to the trials. I stick my nose in all sorts of strange things. I make phone calls. I'm a former municipal judge for the city of Pittsburgh, which is probably the lowest in the rung here. You know, I know that. You know that. I was a traffic judge. But when I get over there, I become the judge. The Irish are great at hyperbole, because I was over talking to somebody in one of the prisons, and I picked up the newspaper that they put out, and they had top U.S. judge. I hope Ray Bush doesn't read about it. I'm in big trouble, but they don't know what to do with me in these situations, because I show up and I wear a tie and a suit, and I used to have a beard, and I look kind of British, and they've never really met a judge yet, you know, because the judges in England and Northern Ireland are kind of high. But, you know, the funny thing about this land of make-believe is that Northern Ireland is a myth. It's a piece of land that's no bigger than, I don't know, Rhode Island. There's 1.5 million people living there. And there are 30,000 British troops for 25 years. If you can imagine 30,000 troops, say in Dane County, I mean, you'd be flowing over all over the place, in the bushes and trees, which is what happens in Northern Ireland. Mary and I went for a little tour. I wanted breakfast, and you might see that I'm a man who always makes sure I get fed. I was coming out of the house with Mary, and as we walked out, there was a soldier sighting in his gun at the door, and he stopped with a rifle pointed at my head. Well, I'm a kid from Brooklyn. I grew up in Brooklyn, and we're kind of outrageous people there. We see a lot of things. Mary came from Oshkosh, and she wasn't quite used to having very soldiers sighting in rifles at her head. She said, I'm going in the house. And I said to myself, I'm hungry. If I go on and he shoots me, I won't eat breakfast. if he doesn't shoot me, I'll have breakfast. I walked ahead and passed it. The other thing is, when you begin to see the slave mentality of the people, and I say, for instance, how would you react to something like this? You see a British soldier walking down the street with one of these attack rifles, and I don't know what they are, but they look powerful. And he's got it pointed down at the ground, which I think is nice. And then you see a little kid on a big wheel go by at the same level as the rifle. I mean, I'm shocked. I had 2 weeks up there. I got to come home. I can't. And everybody goes about, you know, their business as if this is normal. This is the way people live. This is not the way people live. This is not the way people should grow up. Our kids are out playing soccer. They're out playing, well, they're ice skating. They're doing all sorts of wonderful things. Those children are not. Those children are learning hatred. They're learning killing. And they're learning revenge. The scars. Okay. No matter what happens tomorrow, if everybody says, we've been wrong, let's have a whole new system. The scars are so deep. The fathers, the sons, the people who have been killed, the faces who have been shattered by plastic bullets. The scars are so deep, it's going to take decades to disappear. Now, again, when I was born, they tell me through genetics, I was, well, maybe I got in the hospital, you know, we had Irish nurses there.
But I became what is known today as an incurable romantic, which means, as Justin said, the gods may be mad, you know. Because I do believe in justice. You know, I spent 30 years as a lawyer trying to find this elusive thing called justice, trying to find what is fair, you know. Not only what I think is fair, but what is perceived as fair by the people that I'm dealing with. And I tried to do that in Pittsburgh court. The police were not always happy with me because I let people talk and they came up with a sort of most outrageous story. I won't go into it. But I thought that's what law is all about, listening to outrageous stories and letting people feel, no matter how it turns out, that they've had an equal day in court. And that's one of the reasons I keep going back to Northern Ireland, because those people, what they need is what England can't give them. And that's a Bill of Rights. And I realized why we had a Bill of Rights when I was in the DA's office here in Madison from 1966 to 70. I didn't like the Bill of Rights too much, because every time I tried to prosecute a case, somebody was telling me about the Fourth Amendment or the Fifth Amendment. You know, I didn't want to hear this stuff. I was a prosecutor. I wanted to convict people, you know. And it wasn't until later on, maybe when I first saw my first rifles, and I saw that first rifle stuck under my nose, that I realized why we had a Bill of Rights and why it evolved and why we try in our imperfect way to find justice. And why other countries need some kind of a lesson plan. There are people all over the world who are cruelly oppressed. And one Irishman said to me, you know, he said, we've never been the oppressor. Ireland has never conquered any lands. We've always been the oppressed. We've always been the conquerors. He said, when and if we ever get to a point where we have anything to say about our own destiny, we're not looking to march on Scotland. We don't want to attack Wales. You know, there's no big group here saying, let's wipe out Wales. On the other side of the fence, if you go to Southern Ireland, and Southern Ireland, again, is not a very big place, it's only 26 counties. The religions and races live together. Basically, do business together. One of the mayors of Dublin was Robert Briscoe a few years back, who was Jewish. There doesn't seem to be the animosity in the south of Ireland between so-called Protestants and Catholics. I often wondered, I sat up in Belfast one time, I was eating at a Chinese restaurant, and it was one of the safest places, you know. I'm in neutral ground. But somebody was making a speech about how we have to bring both parts of the Christian community together. And I said, you know, if I was Jewish, I'd think I'd be a little offended if I asked. If I was a Muslim, or, you know, if I didn't ask the Chinese about what religion or the crisis or something, I think I might be a little bit unhappy about them saying, let's bring together the two sides of the Christian community, whatever those 2,000 are. The other thing is, all religion is used as an excuse. The people who are battling in the north of Ireland are not religious, although they have leaders who wear collars. And I can understand in our country why we try to keep some of these guys out of politics. But these are old, fairly Old Testament guys. I mean, these are tough to talk. Not only is the Lord going to smoke you, they're going to help the Lord, you know. And they talk to God every day, you know. Somebody once said that when we talk to God, it's called prayer. When God talks to us, it's called schizophrenia. At any rate, that's what you got. Yes, sir.
Hi. Let's see, I want to ask you if you are familiar at all with the Fourth Order of the Orange as a old-time group that historically in the past was not representative of the Protestant or the Presbyterian population of the six counties of the North of Ireland.
Well, the Order of Arms is tied up with Freemasonry and Masons, and they are a political factor of control in the North of Ireland. It's a secret group, and it's a secret in a lot of sense of the IRA. They have a majority control in the RUC, which is the police department. I'm not sure what the control is in the military, but they are a very powerful factor with the Reverend Ian Paisley and a couple of the other reverends.
I was recently reading a geriatric book with Priest of Ireland. He has a whole chapter that's built around this notion of this as a faction within the Protestant community.
Now, in our country, we had groups like that back in the 20s. You know, when the Knights of Columbus started, it started as a reaction to the Masons here. And each group tried to push their own group. But the problem there is it's insidious. I mean, and it's also legal. I mean, these people are like South Africans, in which
he makes a lot of comments of references to the Order of the Orange and the Afrikaners.
Right, because the Afrikaners were also Dutch, and from the ancient order of Orange, that was King Henry the... Oh, is that William of Orange. And the battle that everybody keeps singing about is the battle. I mean, this is a land where Walt Disney was so great. Because the battle they keep talking about is the one between James and William. And nobody knows anything about the history. Because we're talking about a battle for the English crown of a son-in-law against his father-in-law. And we're talking about William, who was Protestant, against James, who was Catholic. Except the Pope backed William. And when William won, there was a mass set in the Vatican celebrating William's victory. Now, some of these things get lost in the crack, you know, with people, because the loyalists have pictures of William, you know, on his horse. Now, William had no use for Presbyterians. He was high church. And the Presbyterians were not wanted under William or Arnold. But anyway, those are the realities. When we rewrite history, we pick out, you know, George Washington on the white horse.
They sound a lot like Southern Baptist, Southern fundamentalists. These orange folks are the way that they've sort of historically have aligned themselves with the British industrialists, which is the root reason for the maintenance.
But don't forget, the British created this. You see, the British created Northern Ireland. They drew a line in the sand. They had, if you go back to history, there was a war between the Southern Irish, or all of Ireland, I should say, and England. It was about the time of the First World War. England wanted to settle, and the way they settled it was to draw a line and say, there, on that side of the line, you're free, on that side of the line, you're English.
But they were able to do that because of the preponderance of the industrialism from Belfast.
They're doing that because, yeah, that's why they wanted Belfast.
Right, they wanted.
But they also had so many more arms. I mean, a nation of, dealing with 40 million against a nation of 4 million. They could have crushed Ireland. They promised Lloyd George that we will crush you. Anyway, that the Southern Irish took to their shame. Because what they did was they sold off their Northern Irish brothers. And there's never been an election of Ireland. Since 1921, there was an election that said they wanted the British to leave. Now, the British have kept Northern Ireland for all sorts of strategic reasons. The last one was the Cold War. The English hated Russia, they feared Russia, they had that. Well, the Cold War seems to have disappeared, but they're still holding on to this little piece of dirt. And why people have to die over a piece of dirt, I don't know. But let me say this, politically, this fellow called Major, who was prime minister, in the British system, they hold their office by how many members in
the House of Commons, that audience. Right now, I think Macon has one vote, majority, the Tories have one vote. And they're about to lose one somewhere in England because of a fight, which will mean he'll have no votes. And then he'll have to rely totally on the 9 votes, the unionist votes in Northern Ireland. And that holds up his country, because if they walk away, they have to call an election and Labour comes in and so on. But, you know, when you come down to this Machiavellian stuff on why people have to be shot, you know, it comes down to money and power. It seems strange. I mean, we all of us long for this little deserted island. There was a fellow named Pete Seeger who wrote a folk song about some little country that has no national army and no national defense. And we're all going to go to this wonderful island. Yeah, but, you know, we never got there. So, as soon as we're born, we're taught 2 things: who to hate and who to fear. I don't know why. I mean, that's the first thing we have to learn. And we're better than somebody else. And they're going to take whatever we have away from us. Yeah.
Yeah, would you get back to your remark? You said there was never an election, actually. Mm-hmm. Could you just outline what's the percentage of the people in the South okay. who've never made an election as opposed to the North?
Well, when they had the last election, it was treaty. I call it a treaty when the English settled the question. And at that time, 80% of the Ireland, the entire Ireland, voted that the British should go. I don't know the numbers. At that time, Ireland was one country. The British put their line through, and then Ireland became 2 countries. And that's the way it stood. Ireland has 1921.
So the decision went over the vote of the Irish, or what? I mean,
well,
how does this function?
The English don't always, with all their talk about democracy, they pick up democracy when it loses.
Oh, yeah,
totally. So, right. There are many times, well, Vietnam, you look at Vietnam, somewhere along the line, we decided Vietnam was wrong. But up until then, it was the national pastime. Now, this is England's Vietnam, and they will not admit that they were wrong. T.S. Eliot said that one of his themes was never apologize, never explain. Well, that's great if you're an artist, if you're a country. You know, it's not always good to teach to them. Once in a while, we got to come out and say, hey, I was wrong. But, you know, I'd like to watch the politicians. Have you ever watched politicians say that they were wrong? They never say, I was wrong. I saw a fellow before hearing the other day, he was talking about these folders and files, and he said, I take responsibility. I said, hey, that's not a politician, is it? That's some sort of government worker. The politicians or governments always come out and say, mistakes were made. And they never say by whom.
That's right.
Mistakes were made. You know, and there's another one that they come out with.
I'm sorry that happened.
Yeah, but they'll never come out and say, hey, you know, I'm dumb. It was my decision. I set those guys. Nobody loves to do that. And they have the principles of democracy are so elusive. You know, it's amazing that one of the prime movers of democracy was a man named Thomas Paine. And his words were an inspiration. But when you come down to it, our revolution was over money, too. You know, we had these lofty. But Thomas Paine was running around with all these wonderful thoughts. He ended up an outcast, drunk in France, no, or England, I'm not sure. Nobody wanted him. He was too much of an irritant. He was too much of a loudmouth. You know, he was too much of, let's get back to principles, you know. And why do the principles say we're all equal? Well, okay, now, that's fine, Tom, the revolution. If you wonder why the Irish have hatred, such a beautiful people, you know, such an open, generous people. Why do they have this hatred? Study the famine. The first thing you do is learn that the famine is an incorrect word. a famine was something that nature brings on, a drought, some sort of bug destroys the crops. The famine in Ireland was used and manipulated and allowed to happen, and over 3 million people either emigrated or died, simply because of the doctrine that they used in England, such a lovely doctrine called laissez-faire. They didn't even use an English one. They just borrowed from the French. And laissez-faire, I guess, in economics, they let them die. But that's what they did. And that's how some of my ancestors, maybe some of your ancestors, left and came there. They couldn't eat. They came on. That whole history of the famine from 1845 to 51 was a horrible time. It was just brutal. And there was more food coming out of Ireland. They were growing more food. They could feed the people of Ireland 3 times with the food that they were exporting to England so that England could feed their colonies. And they watched as their children died. They watched the corn and the wheat being loaded on ships and taken out. William Butler Yeats said, when he was trying to describe the suffering of the Irish, he said, too much suffering makes a stone of the heart. And so when you look at some of the things that are coming out of Ireland, if you look at what makes decent people go to war, what makes nice people, I mean, you've got to meet these people. They don't have horns. They're not born terrorists. They're not born in the gutter with a rifle. They're wonderful people. Why do they battle? Why do they continue? You've got to see what injustice is. Peace doesn't mean anything. The peace process, which is, by the way, there is no peace process. In the beginning, the British, through their secret talks and through the Downing Street Declaration, told the IRA that if you have a ceasefire, we will have talks. So the IRA gambled. And it wasn't a good gamble because they called the British bluff, and the British took the cards off the table and walked out of the room. They had a ceasefire and there were no peace talks. The first thing the British came up with is, well, you have to say that you're permanently giving up warfare. So the British came out, the IRA came out and said, we're giving up warfare. And then the British came back and said, no, no, you have to say permanently. And, you know, they back and forth over the word permanently. Then they got that set of words. And I love the words that are coming out from these people. I heard one time, I was just sitting there listening to a speech in the House of Commons, if you get all the cable TV, so you can't sleep, you know. And Major was talking about free talk talks. That's beautiful. They're going to have a free talk talk. What is that? That's the stall. You see, they're stalling because the English can only lose. And the Irish, who have nothing, can only win. So why have free talk? The next thing was the giving up all their arms. Well, the Irish have been dealing with the British for a long time. And one of the things they learned about is when they had agreements with the British, that the British suffer from something called terminal memory. Sometimes, or selective memory. Sometimes they remember, sometimes they don't. And of course, when you're dealing with an outlaw group, you can't have things written down. Or if they are written down, they're very vaguely set by the free talk talks, and the guy came up with that one. Should write a dictionary. But then Senator Mitchell was sent over. And by the way, I'm not here as a political figure in any way, but one of the biggest thrusts and supports for the Irish nationalism has been Bill Clinton. One of the things he did that was unimaginable was he allowed somebody to come to our country and talk. Now, those of you who have read the First Amendment lately, just think, well, no big deal. what difference would it make if somebody named Jerry Adams, who's the head of a political party, was allowed to come to the United States and talk? But that was a symbol to the British, see, because the British had, up until this point, had kept through censorship as much secret about the north of Ireland and what these people argued about. And we had this picture of these crazy people who were, you know, just running around throwing bombs anywhere, and for no reason. I liked in some of the old German movies or spy movies, they would have the Irishman there, and he would bless himself before he threw the bomb or something. I mean, those are the stereotypes we get. Religious nuts who are totally. Again, when Adams got here, he said he didn't want his kids to learn warfare. He's been shot 3 times. There's a wonderful woman named Bernadette Devlin. I don't know if you've ever heard of her. Little tiny feisty woman. God love her, she's a heroine. And she is the youngest woman ever to be elected to Ames Parliament. And she was sitting there one day listening to some of the British talk about Northern Ireland. And the minister for Northern Ireland got up and said, "We have reached an acceptable level of violence in the north of Ireland." And Bernadette, who's, you know, I don't know, 2 feet tall, she walks up to him, boom, punches him. You know, I'm not an advocate of violence, but if I were there, I would right on out of her. She was so outraged that this man could say a thing like that. She was shot 6 times. Her husband was shot 8 times. And they survived. As they were shot, and the loyalists left their house, the soldiers met the loyalists at the door and arrested them. When Bernadette got a chance, she asked, "Why didn't you arrest them coming in?" And the soldier said, "Our orders were to arrest them coming out." Can you imagine living in a country? Can you imagine that? I can't. And I keep going home there. I sat on 2 inquiries as a judge. One in which a young boy was shot by a British attack rifle for what could have been a traffic violation. His car was filled with 20 shots from the soldiers. When the soldiers finished, walked away, picked up the shells where they fell, which to me means one thing, that they are destroying the crime scene. And they walked away and marched out of the town, leaving the boy dead and his brother dying. Quarter of a mile ago. I sat in on another one where the cab driver was shot at, his passenger was killed, and the police station is 100 yards away. It took them 35 minutes to come out of that police station and come over. In the meantime, the loyalists are running through the field, the state. Why do I keep going back? Because when the gods made us, they first made us mad. And I can go other places. I can go to Harlem. I can go to down south. Maybe I don't go down south because I'd like to understand the language. But I just picked Ireland, and there I am, I guess, for a while. I want to warn you about this when you're through. People like me went through 50 years of secure, happy-go-lucky life. And I woke up one day and I said, "What is this all about? What are we here for? You know, what are these crazy questions that come to you sometimes at 3 o'clock in the morning, and you keep waiting for an answer and there's no answer?" I decided that human rights stuff is an answer. But believe me, it takes over your whole life. It's the worst addiction in the world. And there's very little satisfaction. There's no pay, long hours, intolerable conditions. And I hope none of you catch this disease. My wife wants to wind up go bowling, you know? She said, "Hey, you go down this bowling alley and come home and drink a coke." I don't know, maybe I should have when I was 40, and I think I've been doing this stuff. But by God, it's so great to think somehow, just a little bit here, a little bit there, maybe just that, you know. I love the thing when the peace was the top topic and Clinton was going to Ireland. Everybody and his brother went to Ireland. Mayor Daley from Chicago, who hasn't seen an Irishman in 100 years and wouldn't know what one would look like, he was on the plane. They're all going, you know, peace in Ireland. They're not going on. Not on the plane. And when Jerry Adams first came to this country, nobody heard of him. But all of a sudden, all the politicians were up there, standing next to Jerry Adams, having the films go on. And I said to myself, this is beautiful. This is beautiful. There's nothing better than being recognized by the Vogue magazine. You know? The Lord himself, if he came back, would not get that kind of place. Mahatma Gandhi would not have gotten it. Bishop Tutu would not have gotten it. Well, by the way, for those who you wonder if there are other nationalities getting involved, Mandela and Tutu have both been to Northern Ireland, and there are dioramas on the wall for Tutu and Mandela. There are dioramas on the wall, because that's one of the ways they communicate with each other. They paint on the walls, and there's one for the American Navy.
There's one for Leonard Peltier, too.
Leonard Peltier. And there's so many wonderful people who joined in on this crusade. Now, so when you go home, you might say to yourself, maybe there's another side to what we've been getting. Maybe there's a reason why 25 years mothers would watch their sons put in jail or killed. Why mothers would get on lines and march and have their heads battered and beaten. Why old men would go out in the street and march along under banners. Maybe there's a reason for that. And peace without justice doesn't mean anything. It means wait until next week when we're better prepared. Unless people have justice, not only in Northern Ireland, Chile, South America, wherever we go, unless there is some sort of justice, there's going to be people who will battle. It's that important. I've left some little eclectic literature back there. None of it fits together on anything, but it's just some magazines and some pamphlets that we make available to people. If anyone wants to help yourself, you're welcome. Anything that's back on the bench, Nancy, you.
I think we have to wrap it up.
Yeah,
you
got it.
A couple of questions.
Okay. Yeah, a couple, and I have to.
If they got the vote, would
it
be possible to turn around
like South Africa and have the people? Well, you know, votes are the gerrymandering. That's the other thing they have to be careful. Getting the vote, she says, if they got the vote, that the population, by the way, they talk about 60-40. I think it's closer to 55-40. So when you talk about a minority, you're not talking about a minority. But they have a staggered, some way, a way of voting where if the second place can kind of add the votes to the first place, and I'm not sure how they do it, but you can put two parties together and keep the third party out, and that's what they were doing. The SCLP, which is a Catholic Nationalist Party, has joined in with the Unionist Party to make sure Sinn Féin doesn't win any elections. I mean,
they have a ring.
The vote, like any other vote, has to be fair. It's not enough to say, we'll let everybody vote. The second part of that is the joke. We've got to count those votes. But yeah, voting would make a difference if it was a fair vote. And to me, there's one answer, and it's the answer nobody talks about. It's like having a 10,000-pound elephant in your living room. Everybody steps over and never mentions the elephant, and they always talk about the smell or the crowding. You know, nobody ever mentions the British presence. And that is the seat of, and always will be the seat of problems in Northern Ireland, with the British presence. When they leave, like, and I don't know why they object, they've left so many countries. They've left some countries well and some not so well. They've been told to leave, and some have been friendly. But they ran three-quarters. They ran more land than the Roman Empire at one time, the British. And they treated everyone like children. The Indians, the South Africans, we were all children. Us were all children. And a lot of countries are still coming back because, again, scars are slow to heal.
Yes, sir. Last question.
Last question. Any last one? Yes, ma'am.
I'm still bothered by the IRA bombers in places like Manchester. And I can't see that it's anything but counterproductive to the cause.
I think politically it was a mistake. I think humanly it was horrible. I can't just, there's no way I can justify it. And there's no way I can justify war. And I can only say what Jerry Adams said. He wants to see a stop to all military conflicts, whether it's the British or on their side. He doesn't want to see another rifle or bomb go off.
As corollary, there have been commentaries about Jerry Adams' role in Sinn Féin and the first war in the IRA, saying that he doesn't have as much influence.
The people who say that are the people who sit up and talk about whether the war is effective, it's calm and it's working. I got to end it now. This is another talk. The difference between the IRA and Sinn Féin. Sinn Féin is a political party, runs people for office. It's open. It's visible. They have had, by the way, 19 people assassinated in the last 5 years who have been representatives running for office or holding office on Sinn Féin. Can you imagine that here? 19 people. But they are a recognized political party. The IRA is a hidden guerrilla bunch. And nobody, I can get up here all day and tell you what the IRA thinks or says. I've never, Nancy says I meet them all the time. Maybe I have. The only guy I ever met who said he was in the IRA is a guy living in St. Louis who was fighting deportation. He was in prison years ago, Matt Morrison. I've never met anybody who came out and said, I'm in the IRA. I mean, just saying that's 25 years or something. But Adams is trying to find peace. And I'm sure he's got people in his body that have said, look what's happened with the ceasefire. Nothing. They still won't sit down and talk to us. They're going to have peace talks, but they won't allow the belligerents to sit down. And that's free talk talks. It's a nutty country, a nutty philosophy. And as I say, the British can take 150 years to settle because they are no rush. They are no rush. Anyway, thank you.
Thank you. Continue the work and the operations of this institution. An opportunity now for guests or visitors to introduce themselves. I see Bart Golden is here. Now, I haven't been here in a month or so she's a regular. She may be more regular than me again, but welcome back, Bart.
Stimulated me, and I keep going because of her influence. I think we But I also have some ancestry within this church. My relatives were Christians that came over on the Mayflower, and one was the pastor, Thomas Markison. Thomas Pittman was pastor of the Unitarian Reformed Church there.
Well,
that was the church.
If you attended two consecutive Sundays, you were considered an old timer. I don't know if I'm an old timer yet.
You qualify. An opportunity now for announcements. And we'll start with Arlie first. Our administrator.
Some quick ones. There's new sign-up sheets for various volunteer things here, such as greeter, we really need greeters, coffee setup, cleanup, room setup, child care, right here. There is no service here next week, so it's not pressing, and everybody in this room right now has done more than their share. But if someone could take these to the Green Lodge next week, see if there's some people who have to sign up. Second thing is we're bringing the prairie fire performers here. That's only the 14th of July. The third thing.
I didn't hear that myself.
I'm sorry. Prairie Fire. Next one's still July 14th.
So
it's many things here.
So this today is a Prairie Fire deadline?
Today is not.
Today is not. The next one is July 14th. Okay.
And last, there's a sort of a special edition newsletter going out, and the advanced copy here you would criticize if you like it.
Okay, so there's not a Prairie Fire deadline, because that was a concern to me today. And, okay, thank you. And the other materials. I'd like to pass around a clipboard for lawn mowing and alert Bob Steinhofer to check to see that his name's coming up. But if someone could mow it this week, it'll save Bob a lot of hard work come July 6th and thereafter. So I'm going to pass it around. You can get 3 weeks credit for 1 week work right now. Yes, Barb.
Okay. First two things. Earlier I did a thank you to Reed Miller, who wasn't here at the time, for bringing all the equipment last night. So I want him to be present to hear our applause for that.
Back to you quickly, Barb. Thanks to all the people who made those delicious goodies.
You should clap for them too.
Other announcements? Sorry, announcements. I'd like to move along.
We've got a fundraiser coming up, a Prairie Garage sale. It's going to be held at Pat Lockton's house. But Pat doesn't want, she's just offering us the space. And I don't have your address written down, Pat, so could you tell them?
230 North Meadow Lane.
Kind of right near Hillsdale.
Meadow Lane, for those of you who don't know, is one block. It runs parallel to Midvale Boulevard, one block east of Midvale Boulevard. And it's just almost directly opposite to Hillsdale Shopping Mall.
And this is going to be Friday and Saturday, July 12th and 13th. And we can bring things to Pat on Thursday, the 11th, between 5 and 7 p.m. Eileen Nettleton is organizing it, and she would like volunteers to take time slots to work either the garage sale or getting organized on Thursday. So anybody, you could see me or you could call Eileen, because we need people to work that.
Yes.
Some of you may want to know about the next
Salivar movie. It's going to be July 20th on a Saturday evening at 6. We're going to start a little earlier so we can get the potluck salad bar and the movie and the discussion. It's going to be at our house. And so I just thought I'll be. Movie's a secret right now. Well, you can call this and live at 4606 Washington Street, and you can call us if you're interested.
No, Lita?
This is the basket that's going to be right here as soon as we're done, and we've got some very cold pop left from last night. This is still in the freezer and the refrigerator, and if you'd like to donate to the piano fund, you're welcome.
Bob?
Oh, okay. This is your last chance. This is the end of June. It's the last Sunday to vote for your favorite services of the year. Still, I don't know, I'm counting about 15 of these on hand. If anybody wants to vote before you leave and hand that in, it's your last chance. Anybody want one?
Next? No, let's, maybe they can pick it up afterwards. Okay, next week the program will be, there won't be a program, there'll be a party instead at Shirley Grinrod's, is that correct?
Yeah.
And that's what you're told?
That's what I'm told.
Well, I'm hoping you're volunteering. Okay. And that's going to be at 1 o'clock, is it? And
when people get there, is
okay. When people get there, it's a potluck lunch. I think there's something the most recent prairie fire regarding that. So, other announcements, and then we're going to move along. Reed,
I'm reminded of the notice in the prairie fire about Michael Norman Briggs' 40th anniversary party this afternoon. And if someone here has definitive information as to whether to arrive at 3 or 4, please say so or see me after the program.
All right. Mike and Norma's 40th wedding anniversary potluck party kind of thing at their home on Fox Avenue. So, Mary, were you
right here?
She's ready. So,
well, this is a little confusing. I think it could be a little confusing, but hopefully, if we talk it over first, it won't be. I understand that you all start on page 29, and there's a Flowers of Peace, and that's what it's called. And you sing the first verse and chorus, and second verse and chorus, and then we'll flip over to page 50 and sing the same tune to a different song. Will you go, Lassie, go? The first verse, the chorus, first verse, and the chorus. And so while you're flipping those pages, maybe I'll play a little interlude. So, first I'll play the tune. I don't know if it goes exactly, it's not the same tune exactly as on page 29, but you're going to have to sing that tune anyway. The tune that I'm playing, that is.
Thank you.
play. Just wait.
Thank you.